Welcome to Reinventing Nerds. Dr. Joni Cannell shares communication strategies for technical people. She shares her own stories of learning to communicate and brings in other nerds and experts to show you how to interact with people in a way that's comfortable for you. And now, here's your host, the uniquely qualified engineer-turned-psychologist, Dr. Joni Cannell.
Hello, and welcome to Reinventing Nerds. Today, we have an international guest. Her name is Gina Stetsko. She is the Vice President of Marketing at Eupraxia Pharmaceuticals in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. Gina has been a leader in pharmaceuticals for, we're going to say over 35 years now. In fact, 36 years, I think, to be precise. And she's held executive positions in the pharmaceutical industry, including Vice President of Product Development, Vice President of Operations, and Chief Scientific Officer, in addition to being the Vice President of Manufacturing. So let's welcome Gina. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Joni.
It's so great to have you on today.
Great to be here.
Yeah, especially across the international borders here. This is fun. Well, I was wondering if we could start out with just, briefly telling us your story of how you got to where you're at now.
Oh, boy. It's a long story, but I'll make it short. So as a child, believe it or not, I used to read encyclopedias.
Wow.
And luckily, it's hard to admit, but...
Okay, luckily, we are on Reinventing Nerds, so everybody else would be happy to hear that.
That's my ticket, right? That's my ticket in. So anyway, luckily it was a scientific encyclopedia.
Okay.
So obviously I ended up in science. I chose pharmacy because I was interested in how you could swallow a drug and then it would affect your headache or something else in your body. I had no idea. As a child, you want to know those answers. So I stuck to it and became a pharmacist, and I got my license and decided that I could do more. And my boss told me, go back to school, you can do more than this. So I got my PhD in pharmaceutical development. And I've been spending about, the last 36 years working on developing products and manufacturing products. So I'm taking a drug from the bench in science all the way to the marketplace. So there's a lot of engineering and a lot of pharmacokinetics, and there's a lot of math and science and things like that along the way. So I guess I just really liked it and I stuck with it. The other thing that happened to me was I started to gravitate towards smaller companies. I started out in large companies, and as in smaller companies, we developed the products what's called virtually. So you don't have the full staff within your own company. You have to go outside and hire people at different companies around the world to do your work. And one of the things that taught me was how to deal with different people in different cultures, not only company cultures, but country cultures.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the things I enjoyed the most, not in the beginning because it was hard. But eventually I was always curious and interested to meet people and see how they think. And I think that what's happened over the years is that I enjoy the science less and I enjoy the people more. And that was not on purpose. That just kind of happened. And so now I really enjoy the people and developing the people. And as a matter of fact, there's four people that I mentored at different companies that own their own companies now. And to me, that's like the biggest achievement of my career versus the products, because these people figured out a way to understand themselves better and to be effective in an enterprise like that. So I'm doing the same thing here in a small company in Canada. We're only 20 people, and we're moving a product in through the clinical trials, and I'm also teaching them and helping them develop themselves. So it's right in line with what I'm used to and what I like.
Wow, that's a great story. And it's interesting too. I love the way you're honest about it too, that the part that you love, you didn't love at first because it was hard. I mean, that's great. I mean, really, when you try something, maybe give it a little bit of time. I mean, how much time did it take you to really, get to the point where you were loving it?
Well, let me just tell you the beginning of that. So okay. I actually, you know, thought, well, I'm going to do research. I don't have to deal with people like I did in the pharmacy, you know, because people yeah. come in all the time. And,
okay.
And so little did I know, my first job out of graduate school, I got put on all these international, workshops and workforces and things like that. So I was flying to different countries and I was, had to deal with people. So it kind of forced me. It was kind of, it was a survival thing, I think, kicked yeah. in. And so I realized, well, this is what I'm going to have to learn to do. And I think that in each, you know, life is not perfect. So you make mistakes in each place and you learn things that you bring to the next place. And so over time, I guess over 36 years, it just was one event after another. You know, you build this toolbox. And that's really, in a way, what's happened over the years, different challenges in different countries and different situations, and you just adapt.
Yeah, interesting. You know, well, I know that we've talked in the past about your leadership style, and I really want to get that out there for our listeners because I think it's really interesting. You talk about how you used to be more intellectual in your leadership style, and then you moved to more compassionate way of being. So what does that mean? And, you know, how did that come about?
Well, you know, I don't really know. There wasn't like an event. Mm-hmm. I think that I used to think that if I was smarter, I was better. And so you're always looking to be the smartest one in the room, right? Mm-hmm. And I realized that you reach a point where people kind of, that irritates people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it really does. I mean, it's like, okay, so, you know, you've got to not be the smartest person. And then I realized that to get people that work for me to be more effective, they really needed to feel that I heard them, right? So instead of coming to my office for me to solve their problem like I was when I was younger, you know, I had all the answers, right?
Right.
It's draw it out of people. And so it's avoiding giving the answer and saying, well, I don't know. Let's work on that together. Or what do you think? And the more I did that, it made my job easier, right? I didn't have to be the smartest person anymore because the pressure was off of me. And what I did was the pressure wasn't actually, well, I guess it was on those people because I was forcing them to really dig deep and think about what they wanted. And then over time, I think I built a style that made it feel safe for them to speak, you know, what was inside. Mm-hmm. And then I really liked that. I just, something clicked in me that I really like to understand that. I mean, even in my private life, I do that with people too. Mm-hmm. I said, tell me more about that. Oh, yeah. Why did you feel that way? Or I'm just curious, you know, I just became a very curious person.
Yeah.
So it's really a shift from trying to be the smartest person to being just a really interested, truly interested in other people. And that's the compassion part, right? I mean, I think people don't normally get that.
So the compassion to me sounds like you're interested, but then you also added the safety part of it too. And compassion sort of means in my book, like a little bit of feeling like you can be nicer to people and understand when they're having challenges. And you don't always have to agree. You don't always have to be in their shoes, but you can at least understand what they're saying. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that everybody, and this was really a learning from working with people in other countries because, you know, everybody has their own life and they put their, you know, their vision of reality together differently. Nobody's the same. And so you can have a prescribed answer for people. Everyone has to come at it from wherever they came from in a way, right? So that's where drawing it out, you get people to question their rules and their vision of themselves and their vision of the situation to say, well, maybe there's another way to look at it. And I think that's a key to having them feel that we're working together to help you. That's, to me, that's the compassion part, yes. is to say, you're important and let's get you to figure it out so that you can carry that forward on your own.
Yeah.
And then teach other people as well. So, you know, I think that was one of the things that I saw, that what I was doing was going beyond that one conversation.
Yes.
And yeah.
Do you have an example of somebody that you've worked with, like in maybe one of the other countries that you're talking about, where that came out?
Well, yeah, there's a good one. So I was working in France, and luckily my staff had been speaking English for 25 years. So when I apologize for my bad French, they go, no, you're making our English better. So they had some compassion too. For me. But we had a department that really wasn't needed anymore at the company, and because of our business changed. And this one gal that worked for me, we talked a lot about how to reassign her, some of the people that worked for her, and we did that. And then she said, well, okay, well, what about me? And so it got into a situation where my boss, who I really didn't get along with, wanted me to just fire her. And I said, no, let me talk to her and come up with a good, a good result, right? Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of conversations, and I spent a lot of time asking her what she really liked. What does she really want to do? What's her passion? To try and get her to do a lot of thinking. And she would go home, she'd talk to her husband, she'd come back in and said, no, we talked together about our future. And I was like shocked that she was sharing all this stuff with me.
Yeah.
And it was really good. And there was some crying, and it was really, really good. And we got to the point where, I was talking to her about things she could do outside the company. And I think there was a fear of just not finding something. Right.
Right.
I mean, that there was nothing out there for her. Mm-hmm. And she got to the point where she said, this really isn't the place for me. I need to just take the plunge kind of and go out there. And my husband is supporting me. He said, no matter what, just I want you to be happy. So they got to that point that gave her permission to go. Right. Mm-hmm. And about 3 years later, I'm on LinkedIn with her, and I see that she's a founder of a small company. Uh-huh. A small pharmaceutical company in France. And I was crying. I was like, this is fantastic. She never would have gone there without those discussions. Or if I had just fired her, who knows what would have happened. So, I think that's really compassion. I spent a lot of time listening to her and just asking her questions so that she could get to wherever she was going to go.
Yeah.
And it worked out really well. That's probably, that's a 10 out of 10, I think.
Yeah, certainly compassion of not firing somebody and
Well, he told me a lot of things to do and I didn't do them. And then I eventually got fired. And by the way, I want to say I got fired. Everyone was proud of me. I got a lot of congratulatory notes from people. And I asked him, I said, well, I want to know why. And he goes, because you always want to do the right thing.
Mm.
And I said, that's okay. I can accept that.
Fired.
Yeah. I accept that. And he just got fired last year.
Yeah, interesting.
So anyway.
Another good story there, a little zinger.
Yeah, well, you don't want to hear all the details about that one.
Yeah. Well, I do want to ask you about something, though, which is, when you did make this change, what was that like with inside of you? And in terms of, you felt like maybe even was there something within you that made you feel like you had to be a better leader, or did it just sort of come over time naturally, or how did that come about?
It wasn't intellectual.
Yeah.
It happened. There's a number of people on YouTube I have to thank.
Okay.
Because I got into this YouTube thing where I would take some time and I would listen to inspirational things. I was subscribing to TED Talks.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to Brené Brown, who everybody knows now, but when she first did her talk she was just a researcher from Texas, you know, at a university, right? And she talked about vulnerability, and it hit me between the eyes, you know? And that was probably the biggest turning point. I mean, I listened to a lot of Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer and, you know, people like that as well. But that one, I think, was really the one that hit home. And then when I went to work, I would be, I felt free to tell people, I don't know. I don't have the answer. You're going to have to help me. Mm-hmm. And so I asked the people that work for me for help. That's the turning point, I think.
Yeah, no, that's
because,
big.
Yeah, and they it was funny because they always wanted me to come to the meetings. The person that I replaced when I went there was a French manager. And there, they always wanted the French manager to give them the answer.
Yeah. Right?
So people would invite me to meetings, and I go, I'm not coming. And they go, well, we need you there. We need you to give us the answer. And I said, look, I said, you know this stuff better than I do. I want the group to decide, and then you come tell me later what you decided. And if it's not okay, I'll let you know. And you know what?
That's very empowering, yeah.
They never came to talk to me. Ever again. Though you would come and tell me what happened.
Right.
And I would say, good for you. And I never had to go to those meetings. So again, I made my job easier mm-hmm. by making them dig inside themselves, and also collectively as a group, they had to learn to work together because I wasn't going to be there to mm-hmm. referee. Mm-hmm. And that was an experiment on my part. I didn't know that was going to work, but it did.
Yeah. And well, you also gave them the checkpoint of like, come to me and I'll let you know if, you know, you need to make a change with their decision, right?
Right. And I even said, well, if you get stuck and you need me, you know, tell my secretary and she'll come get me. But they never did.
Yeah.
So.
Huh. You know, I like that. You know, I mean, just you're really empowering people. And then you're saying, but I am here if you really need me. And that almost sort of gives people the opportunity to say, oh, no, 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 we don't need you.
Well, So in a way, in a roundabout way, it was like, if you come to me, you haven't done well, right?
Yeah.
And so I didn't think about that at the time, but afterwards I thought about it and I said, well, they're not coming to me because then they're going to admit failure, right? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't smart enough to figure that out ahead of time, but I really did want them to work together. And there were factions, you know, when I came there, that people didn't talk to one another and stuff like that. So it forced them to have to, you know, figure it out.
Mm-hmm. And yet, did they make mistakes and stuff along the way? Did you have to coach them through that, or how did that go?
I would say no major mistakes. I mean, there were some things that, you know, it seemed like a reasonable thing that I wouldn't have probably come up with a different answer.
Right.
It might not have worked out. So I wouldn't call it, you know, a mistake. I would call it, you know, a best guess that, you know, that had to be changed. You know, but I didn't say no catastrophic mistakes or anything like that.
Well, I think that's huge too, that you're saying that it was okay for them to do it differently than you would. That's sort of taking that micromanagement piece out of there, right? And saying, no, we can do it in a way that you've developed, and I can help you through that too as the leader.
Right. I mean, they've been working, you know, at that company for 20 years, and here I come in 1 year. You know, I sat down all my direct reports. I had 12 direct reports. And I said, look, you guys have been doing this for 20 years. I'm just coming here. I'll teach you what I know. You teach me what you know. Mm-hmm. But you guys know all the details, and I'm not going to micromanage you guys, right?
Right.
So that's another reason why, because I had a lot to do. I was in the head of all of research. I had 75 people, and there's no way that I could have dug into all the details of how they do everything, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just there's no way. So, you know, they knew their area, and anything that overflowed into what I knew, that's what I get pulled in on.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So it was a kind of a collaboration in a way versus a top-down situation.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to shift a little bit to talk about how you develop people. I mean, this is how you empower them, and I suppose they develop themselves a little bit along the way, but do you have specific strategies that you use to help other people change and to develop themselves?
Well, I think the first thing is that you really need to observe and not make a snap judgment, right? A categorize. People like to put people in boxes.
Yeah.
You know, and because every company and every country and every situation is different. And you have to, as a leader, give yourself time to understand the landscape, not only of the country and the company, the products, your peers, the managers, or your CEO, and you know, you need to get a sense for the culture and the vibe, and also spend enough time with the people, not just in meetings, but in other kinds of situations. I like traveling with people because you have a lot of downtime and you're sitting and chatting, yeah. And people talk about their families and their hobbies and stuff like that. So you really need to get a well-rounded view of somebody before you launch into say, oh, you know, this person needs this or this person needs that. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. It's a commitment to really understanding someone before you come up with a plan. And then, you know, you need to think about what kind of runway they have and they need. So where are they now? Where can they go? And what are the possible steps, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm dealing with someone right now and they, you know, I'm seeing opportunities opening up. So I'm trying to put this person in these opportunities because that's going to move them further down the road a couple steps to where I know they can go.
Yes.
You know, so you look at their talents, you look at their ability to interact with people, their flexibility, their openness and things like that. And there's different jobs that are going to fit different people, right? And so you basically, it's not a short-term thing. You have to look at the next 3 to 5 years for that person and that you may have to build some stepping stones for them, right?
Mm-hmm. But it also sounds like you're not just trying to hoard them to yourselves, that your stepping stones could be for them to move on and move out and move into other areas.
Yes.
Part of their right. development. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because again, like I that example of feeling really good about this person, where they ended up, that's what it's all about. So, you know, it doesn't matter where the person's going to go as long as they have a good result in the end. Because
right.
that when I leave the company, that's what I'm going to think about. I'm not going to think about the products necessarily. I will, but I mean, you know, it's the people for me, it's the people that I've dealt with and knowing that they have families that are prospering and, you know, it goes beyond that one person, right?
Well, let me ask you a couple questions about that. Because first of all, one of the fears that I hear from people is that, well, you know, you don't want to invest all this time developing someone and then have them leave. How do you handle that aspect of it?
I mean, that would be awful to say, you know, I'm not going to let you improve because I want to keep you working for me. I mean, that's, I would say that person really needs some help. I mean, that's like anti-compassion. Like, what do you call that? I don't know.
Oh,
what do you,
you know,
what do
you
call
that? Hoarding. Dollars, right?
You call it hoarding people? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I'll just talk broadly. We're on this planet, you know, to experience other people and to have our own experience. And it's not about business. We do business to live and to do those other things we want to do.
Yes.
And so I guess I look at it as, you know, we're just a collection of people trying to, you know, find our way, if you will.
Yeah.
I think it was Ram Dass said, you know, all we're doing, we're all walking each other home. And I like that quote because I think that's true, that really, you know, we're just trying to help everybody have the best result. At least that's my view, whether it's a business or anything else. right?
Well, there would be some reward in that too. I mean, if you are having people develop, maybe they can move up within the company, or, you know, you have connections outside, and hopefully you have a pipeline of people, right? I mean, that seemed to me, if you're, everyone's growing, you'd have a pipeline that you can draw on for to replace them as well, no?
That's right. That's right. And the other thing is, well, it's maybe it's not easy to do it right away, but that person should be developing other people as well.
Oh, yes.
So if it's if it's somebody that's really going to move up, they really aren't, they really shouldn't be moving up unless they're also developing people, because when they get to that higher level, they're going to do more of that, right? So, you know, I always do that when I mean, even in France and here, I talk to the people that work for me about the people that work for them. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, what about Joe, or what about Michael? What are you doing? What are you doing with them? You know, how are, or I might see a project and I go, this is a good project for Michael. You know, maybe, what do you think about that? Think, you know, go off and think about that. So I'm always looking to go the next level down. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, just another, I know these thoughts are coming up. There was a technician in France, who had been there 30 years, but in the French system, those people aren't recognized because they're not management, right? They're just kind of in the basement doing the work, right?
Okay.
Important work.
Yeah.
And so we had a project where we had to come to the U.S. and work with a company that I had built a relationship with. So my manager was coming, and I said, well, why don't we bring, I can't remember, it was Philippe, with us. And everybody was like, what? He's only a technician. You know, but he's only a technician with 30 years experience, right? He's the smartest person in the company. So we brought him along. It's the first time he'd traveled for the company. Hmm. And we went to meet for dinner, and he goes, I'm taking you out for a drink. He celebrated the whole thing, and it was the greatest thing. And it went through the whole company. So, you know, I think that looking beyond the people that just work for you can have a huge impact, and you might be surprised by how much of an impact that has.
Wow. And morale and all sorts of things too. Well, I had another question for you, but I think you've kind of answered it, but you know, maybe in terms of just thinking about it broadly for advice to others too. I mean, the excuse I often hear, rationale, excuse, whatever it is that, you know, in hard driving tech companies, they're saying, we don't have time to develop people. You know, there's just no time, you know? And so what's your response to that?
Well, I guess I would first have to understand their situation. And is it really as dire as they're saying, or is it an excuse? Mm-hmm. Because there are some situations, and I have been in situations myself, where you don't have enough resources, and you know, it's like you only have 5 fingers to put in the dike, you know, or 10 fingers to put in the dike, right? Mm-hmm. And so you run out of fingers and you're scrambling around. So there are always those situations where you're just trying to keep your head above water, right? Mm-hmm. But I think in some cases that could be an excuse. Because they're so busy, they can't figure out a way. They're so focused on solving the problems that they don't have a longer term view of the department or the company.
Right.
And obviously, you have to, part of your responsibility as a leader is to help build the company, not just solve problems in front of you. And so you need to break out some time to do those kinds of things, right? And, you know, Simon Sinek had a quote I really like. He says, if you don't understand people, you don't understand business. Hmm. So it's a collection of people, you know, working towards a goal. And so if all you're doing is solving problems all day long and not looking after the future, you know, resources of the company, mm-hmm. The company won't be successful. So, you know, I've been in some companies where we're an executive team and the CEO goes, okay, what are we doing about people? And it's a topic because it's just as important as money or partnership or contracts or partnerships or anything else. it's a resource to get things done. So, you know, so I don't really buy that. I mean, in certain situations, I think, yes, you are pressed for time because of emergencies, but that shouldn't be 100% of the time.
Yeah, so I guess what I'm hearing is that you have to balance a little bit of the short-term and the long-term thinking there, because your company's not going to be around if all you think about is short-term.
Yeah, and the other thing I think that senior management really needs to set, have their leaders have a piece of their goal to be a people goal. You know, right. What are you doing about hiring? What are you doing about training? What are you doing about promoting? Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe it's 15% of their annual assessment or something, but yeah. It's got to be in there, because what you measure, you reward, right?
Yep.
So.
Yeah. And I also heard, I mean, that's why I was saying you kind of answered the question, but throughout the interview, you've given a lot of creative ways to develop people that don't necessarily have to take up a lot of time, like just empowering them or giving them opportunities to do projects that you think they can handle that will help them grow. It's not like you're sending them off to a leadership development course for, you know, a couple of weeks. You're actually having them do the work that, while they're developing.
Oh, you pushed a hot button on me. That is a total waste of time. You get a binder, you put it on the shelf, and you forget about it. No, it's the soft stuff. It's the little stuff. And you don't have to be a psychologist. You don't have to be, you know, somebody who is, you know, gives surveys and scores the people and all that stuff. I mean, that's for people outside the company to come in and help you with. But, you know, I think that it's a mindset, you know, and I think that you can't just tell people you need to do this as a leader. You need to do this and it just happens. You can't go to a 2-day seminar and say, just here's the checklist of 10 things to do and everything will be fine. It's kind of looking inside yourself, and nothing will change until you change your view of what is going on around you as a leader. And I think that's the thing. I think people don't spend the time on that. And then they go, well, just send you to a course. Mm-hmm. And it never works.
Yeah.
Rarely works. I mean, I'm sure it does have some effect on some people, but I haven't seen it really have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been really interesting. I mean, you're sort of summing it up here by it really is a mindset. And, you know, you shifted yours as a leader from being more of an intellectual mindset to a compassionate one. And this whole idea of needing to develop people along the way to have a better company and a business strategy is also a mindset. So yeah. I think that kind of sums it up for people. If you want, have to people reach you after the show, do you want to share some contact information or?
I'm on LinkedIn and that's probably the best way. And they can reference this podcast and then I know that the connection and then I can respond to them. That's probably the best way.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, you know, this has been super interesting. I really appreciate you going across the borders here to give our listeners some tips on how to be a more compassionate leader and just think about within how they can be a better leader. So thank you, Gina, for being on our show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Oh, great. Well, you know, this is Reinventing Nerds. We're here at reinventingnerds.com. And you don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review, and we'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reinventing Nerds and encourage you to apply what you learned to help you communicate better. For a free consultation with Joni to see how she can help you further, please visit reinventingnerds.com. Until then, embrace your inner nerd and remain true to yourself while you develop your communication strategies.